This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer, Australia's only LGBTIQ plus national news and current affairs show. Proudly sponsored by KHQ Lawyers. Passionate about being the best.
Have you ever wondered what would happen if we ran out of petrol? Recent attacks on two oil facilities in eastern Saudi Arabia have put Australia's own energy supplies into question. To ensure we don't run out of petrol and other forms of oil we use for energy, Australia maintains something called a strategic reserve. Except we don't maintain anywhere near the amount recommended by a range of other countries. To find out more about the situation, Arian Potts spoke with Dr. Jesse Moritz from Australian National University's Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies. Here's Dr. Moritz.
The history of the relationship between Saudi, Iran, and also the Houthi rebels in Yemen is important here. So that both the Houthis and Iran are majority Shia, whereas Saudi Arabia is majority Sunni, or specifically Salafi or Wahhabi Sunni. Whereas there is a distinction, though, between types of Shiism. So there's been sometimes this narrative of a sectarian crescent across the Middle East, and the Saudi government would put the Houthis squarely in the middle of that. They would view them as indistinguishable from Iran itself. What that means in practice is that there are some religious distinctions in terms of religious practices. The Houthis don't necessarily accept the supreme leader of Iran as to the same extent as do Twelver Shias. What that means is they're not necessarily a natural extension of the arm of the Iranian state. From the Saudi perspective, they view, because they don't draw a distinction between the Houthis and the Iranian state itself, this is Iran taking a capital, pushing out the government that they support, which is under Hadi at the moment, they're firing rockets at Saudi territory. This isn't the first time that the Houthis have fired on Saudi territory, if indeed this was the Houthis. So there's a complex relationship. There's a history going on behind this. It's not, I wouldn't call it a natural sectarian conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran, between Sunni and Shia, because there are ethnic identities there. Iran is Persian. Saudi Arabia is Arab. There's a geopolitical element of competition. They have very different visions for what they want to see happen in the Middle East. So they have a history of contentious relations, especially from 1979. There's a sectarian element in terms of whether or not the Houthis should be viewed as a proxy for Iran. And there is more and more evidence, as the civil war has worsened, there is more evidence that the Houthis, at least pragmatically, have been accepting arms and training from the Iranian government. But the exact relationship between the two remains a bit contested.
Looking at the location of the El Kaik and Qurais oil fields, they're only about 270-ish, well, El Kaik is about 270 kilometers from Iran. And if,
yes,
you know, it's 800 plus kilometers to Yemen. So, you know, do you know anything about the capabilities of the drones that the Houthi may or claim to have?
First of all, whatever we're talking about, we're probably talking about Iranian weapons. The Saudis have come out and said that. I believe the US may have as well. So whether it was the Houthis that fired it or Iran that fired it, the origin of the weapons is likely to be Iran. The question is, who did fire it, and did the Houthis, if it was the Houthis, did they fire it of their own accord, or did they fire it on the suggestion of the Iranians? But in terms of the technology, it's very likely to have originated from Iran. The Houthis have been firing rockets at Riyadh Airport. They claimed that they had fired some at the Dubai and Abu Dhabi airports, but that was never confirmed. They've been particularly focusing on border areas of Saudi Arabia and Riyadh, as well as attempting strikes against oil infrastructure. Whether or not at the moment, they're known to have acquired systems for strikes that can fly up to about 1,500 kilometres, and they don't need a particularly high level of technology beyond that to conduct a strike like this. But the question is, the US has suggested that because these attacks came from the northwest, that the angle of the attacks seems a bit odd if they originated from Yemen. So that's why there's this question about who conducted these strikes, despite the Houthis claiming that it was them. So one of the reasons why Abqaiq itself is so important is that, according to the Saudis, it's the world's largest oil processing facility. So the eastern region of Saudi Arabia is not just a home for Saudi's minority Shia population. It's also it's also where a lot of the oil wealth in Saudi Arabia is concentrated. So this is kind of the heart of the Saudi oil industry. Abqaiq processing facility is important not just for its size, but for the volume of Saudi oil that it's responsible for. So normally it produces around about 7 million barrels per day. And these strikes have caused output to be cut by 5.7 million barrels per day, as far as we're aware so far. So that's really significant. They normally are responsible, this processing facility, for 7% of the world's global output.
And if we're looking at wholesale prices, should we be looking at the Tapis crude price to see the impact on wholesale prices for Australian distribution?
Yeah, the Tapis crude price is usually used in sort of Southeast Asian prices. In terms of looking at the impact closer to Saudi Arabia, the Brent crude price is usually mm-hmm. fairly close. It's sort of the benchmark price used for Saudi Arabia. Obviously, the West Texas intermediate price has also jumped significantly. So you'd expect there to be flow-on effects to all different types of crude oil, and then through that, slowly into markets.
Earlier, we were hearing Arian Potts discussing the conflict with Dr. Moritz between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Arian also spoke with John Blackburn, a former Air Vice Marshal and Deputy Chair of Australia's Air Force, who is now a consultant on defence and national security, about Australia's strategic reserve of oil. Here's John.
I've been looking into this issue of our fuel security and our energy security for the past 7 years, and I'm quite concerned about it. More than 90% of our transport fuels are imported, either as oil or refined fuels. We don't really have a plan of how we deal with some sort of supply interruption. And that's not just me saying this. The International Energy Agency reviewed Australia's energy policies back in 2018, and they said they couldn't see or understand how we in Australia would deal with a major oil supply disruption. Now, part of the reason for them saying that is that we're a bit different to a lot of other countries, other developed countries. For example, we don't require industry to hold minimum stock levels. In other words, the four oil and fuel companies, the big ones who bring fuels into Australia, we don't say to them, hey, you've got to have X number of days of stocks. Most other developed countries do. Our government also doesn't own any of its own stocks that could help in the event of a supply disruption in Australia. So that's a pretty significant risk. And the question I've been asking is, why are we so different from all these other countries in the world who do mandate stock levels, who do have their own stocks, and who are concerned about their fuel security?
The U.S. Strategic Reserve came out of originally fuel for the Navy and keeping a strategic amount of that. Does the Royal Australian Navy have its own reserve, and can that be used for the public?
Well, I had a senator once say to me, look, if we ever have a problem, we'll just go down to the nearest military base and we'll get their strategic reserves. Well, Defence doesn't publish its stock holdings, but we don't hold strategic reserves in this country. What we've got is the military has training stocks and sufficient stocks for its current peacetime operations, but we don't have anything like the stock holding that the US has or a lot of other countries have that gives them that resilience.
So the Australian market doesn't have resilience because it doesn't have the backup?
Pretty much. So, for example, at the moment, there's about 22 days on average of diesel in the country. But back at the end of 2016, early 2017, we were down to 12 days. Now, if there's an interruption of supply, and I'm not talking about supply being completely cut off, but if there's something like we've just had in the Middle East that gets extended or further attacks, or if the US is currently locked and loaded, apparently, decides to do something about Iran, then that's going to get quite interesting, and it would affect global supplies of energy. We need to be able to have a plan of what we'd do if it happened.
And these stocks are held at refineries, roughly?
Well, it's what's accounted there, I understand, is they get the oil and fuel companies to say what they've got at the refineries, at their storage depots. And when I did my fuel study, there's about 3 days' worth of stocks off in a garage, but that, you know, like the service station you go down to.
Yeah.
But it can run out pretty quickly. In 2014 in Victoria, they had a problem at the Geelong refinery when the Altona refinery was down for maintenance. And the Geelong refinery went down. Within 2 days, there were diesel fuel shortages in Western Victoria and Gippsland. And I know it because my brother-in-law, for example, was a farmer. He and his farming mates were talking about getting trucks and heading into New South Wales, trying to get some diesel to take the crop off.
For Australia's situation, could we just start using LPG? You know, convert cars en masse?
No. Look, some cars work on LPG, and there's storage of about, I was told, it's about 60 days of LPG up in Sydney Caverns. And when I asked the people in that sector of the industry, well, how do you get the LPG to the garage? Oh, by truck. and what's the fuel the trucks use? Oh, it's diesel.
Mm.
So let's just say that that hasn't been thought through. Companies are actually cutting back on the LPG that they're putting out in rural areas because there's not much profit in it. So the distribution chain's reducing. But what's really important is that this country runs on diesel, whether it's the trucks that move 80% of our domestic freight to the food deliveries. In Melbourne, one of the reports we saw recently said there's 15,000 tonnes of food delivered every day in Melbourne. How do you reckon it's actually transported? Well, it's truck and it's diesel. The solution in the longer term, you're right, you've got to have a diversity of energy sources for transport, whether it's electric, hydrogen, vehicles and trucks, compressed natural gas can do some, gas, LNG and other areas can be looked at for part of a transport. And so what you want to do is have a diversity of energy sources for your transport, and you want to make sure a fair chunk of those can be produced in Australia. So we're not dependent on the import chain if there is some sort of interruption.
Mm-hmm.
But to come up with that, you need to have a plan. And the plan would be is how you diversify the energy types, what resilience you build into it. And I've got to tell you, we don't have a plan.
The Wall Street Journal just published a story about 3 hours ago going over the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. They say that it's currently at 644.8 million barrels. It's in Texas and Louisiana in salt caverns.
Yep.
Interestingly, the way that they get it out apparently is to pump water in to make the oil rise. The journal reported it would take 2 weeks to get to U.S. domestic markets. And they say there aren't enough pipelines and export terminals to carry out the reserves to match the 5.7 million barrels of lost output. If Australia and the U.S. both need to draw on that at the same time,
it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because the other thing is we don't have any Australian flagships capable of carrying that oil. So if it was such that you get the US to actually release it in a crisis, it should be to the market, not to be shipped to Australia. But if you try to do it, you're going to have to contract foreign-owned ships to bring it here. Okay. And when you get it here, is it the right type of oil that our refineries can use?
Right.
Because three of our refineries require a heavy crude, one can process a light crude. And so this is really... I think it's just clever marketing. Oh, yes, we're taking care of our security. We'll pay for money, go in Louisiana. Hang on. We've got to fix our domestic security first, and in doing so, help fix the other problem, not the other way around.
Yep. And the oil would have to go through the Panama Canal. And so different size ships. And
Yep.
Because if it's coming from Louisiana, or it's going around Africa.
I mean, the oil lobby groups here in Australia say, they've tried to say when I've joked about this overseas, no, if you have oil overseas, it's not for our domestic use. This is a global market factor. And they're right in that case.
Yeah.
It is for global market effect, which is an important thing to address. But if we do that and don't address our domestic energy security, then we are incredibly vulnerable. They're not going to take all this time to ship out and come and save us if things go wrong.
Yeah.
We've got to be resilient enough in Australia to look after ourselves for a period of time if the amount of energy or oil and fuel reduces. I'm talking about a reduction in flow. This is why the Parliamentary Joint Committee last year, March 2018, chaired by Andrew Hastie, said, look, we need to analyse and produce a plan of how we are going to assure a sufficient flow of fuel in Australia to meet national security needs. Now, that's not just defence.
Yeah.
That's to sustain things like food distribution, you know, medicine distribution, all the services. Can you imagine if you couldn't take waste away, for example? So we've got to keep our society functioning if there is some sort of supply interruption. This is not 100% loss, but what's the percentage of our normal oil and fuel consumption that's necessary to keep in place to keep critical services working in the event of a partial interruption of supply? Well, I've got to tell you, we don't know because they haven't done the analysis.
That was John Blackburn speaking to Arian Potts.
This is The Informer, Australia's only LGBTIQ+ national news and current affairs show. Proudly sponsored by KHQ Lawyers. Passionate about being the best.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.